I'm turning now to the book of the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 47 and verse 1. Ezekiel, chapter 47, verse 1. Afterward, he brought me again unto the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward, for the forefront of the house stood toward the east. And the waters came down from under, from the right side of the house, at the south side of the altar. And our subject is Understanding Ezekiel's River of Life. And as we have been noting in our studies, not exhaustive studies by any means, not dealing with every passage in this prophecy of Ezekiel, but with highlights, with chief pivotal chapters. In our various studies, we've noted that most of Ezekiel's visions are prophetic parables. They are not to be interpreted literally, as though they represent things that would exactly happen in the world as they are described in the chapters, in the prophecies. Now, Ezekiel, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, provides us with constant indicators that he is speaking in pictures, in figures, not to be taken absolutely literally, but to be searched for their spiritual fulfillment and sense. And even in recent studies, we've looked, for example, at the valley, the vision of the valley of dry bones, the dry bones that lived. And it is obviously figurative. That's so plain. And then immediately after that, there was the assault set up by Gog and Magog. And again, Ezekiel leaving many indications that he is speaking prophetic parables, because he uses extinct nations and princes, not entirely, but 50% in that vision of the attack on the unfolding church in its gospel era and gospel history, and many other indications we looked at also. And constantly there is symbolism, and here it is too, in this 47th chapter, as we shall see. We've looked at the previous chapters, the very unlikely temple in the vision, with measurements that are often contradictory, impossible to carry out by any builder. Sometimes the interior of the temple is larger than the entire temple precincts. And there are these indications that we're following the language of prophetic parable, and that Ezekiel speaks of a coming age, and particularly of the future of the church in the age of the gospel after Christ. And we've looked at those indications. But here is the river of life. It's not the only place in the prophecies of old where we have reference to this river, or indeed in the New Testament, the river of life. Now, constantly we've been noting also, just to prepare us for this particular passage, that the church of the New Testament will be a separated church, a distinct community, a distinct people. In fact, where Ezekiel does refer to past history, he reproves the priests of Israel severely from God and denounces them and condemns them for their chief error and sin, which was to confuse sacred and profane and to not maintain the sacred things of God's worship and the temple, and to allow those who are unclean into those sacred premises. So there is great condemnation for the church and the world being mixed, and for the future it will not be mixed, but the church will be distinct and separate. Now, this is a mistake which is frequently made today, as you know, that the church adopts worldly things, that individual Christian people often lead very worldly lives, fulfilling their earthly desires, self-indulgence and earthly indulgence in possessions, in behaviour, in recreations, in entertainments, and it comes even into the worship of the church. Well, all that is condemned in the repeated prophecies and visions of Ezekiel. But here we come to a chapter which speaks more positively of our relationship with the world. While we are to be distinct and separate and untainted by it and uninfluenced by it, yet we have an outreach to it and a mission. And our work in the world for the gospel will lead even to many ordinary blessings for people and provisions for people in the world. From this river of life will come untold benefits and secondary benefits for the world, for society, for civilization. So we're going to be looking at the river of life in Ezekiel. And it's anticipated before even the first temple in the tabernacle. There's the laver of brass. There is the water provided near to the altar for the washing of all the sacred utensils and the priests and their garments. So water has always been a feature of the temple, and it's used for ceremonial cleansing. And in Solomon's temple, there it was also, a great sea, it's described as, encased by brass for all these ceremonies, probably supplied by plumbing of quite a sophisticated kind. But in this temple, the temple that's been described in the preceding chapters, the water is not coming from any visible place, and we'll speak about that, but you look at verse 1, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house. They welled up on the great entrance step of both the north and possibly the east entrances, but they welled up somehow and began to flow out from that point. They're anticipated also in other prophecies. In Psalm 46, this temple vision of the influence of the church in a future age is anticipated. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. What's that but a prophecy in the Psalms of this very same river? So it flows from under the threshold. It's a remarkable river. And it shall be in that day, we're told in Zechariah, in a parallel prophecy, that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem. It's not only Ezekiel. In Joel chapter 3, verse 18, there's also a reference to this mystical, figurative river. A long reference in Isaiah chapter 35, which I'll have cause to refer to a little later. And then the Lord Jesus Christ in John chapter 4 and verse 10. And what is this but this river explained for his own age and work? Jesus answered and said unto her, the woman at the well, if thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou wouldst have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. And in verse 13 of that same John chapter 4, Jesus answered and said unto her, whoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again, but whoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. And that is undoubtedly a reference back to the river of living water that the prophet said would flow from the temple in that day when Messiah came. So let's look at the individual verses, and then I'll give the sense. And remember, they're about how the church relates to the world. Verse 1, we've already noted, a flowing stream comes out of the temple from under the threshold, and I'll comment on that. This is, of course, impossible, literally, because we're on a high mountain. The temple vision and the construction of this vast, vast temple, far bigger than the whole of ancient Jerusalem in its dimensions, is situated on top of where? Well, it's far too big for Temple Mount, unless in the vision it's greatly enlarged. It's not literal, you see. But what is the source of a stream of water coming there from the top of a mountain? It's not natural, it's not possible, it's not right. And these are just indications that Ezekiel leaves all the way through, that we're not talking about a natural, literal event. We're talking about a prophecy in a symbol. And then you go to verse 2, then in the vision brought he me out of the way of the gate northward and led me about the way without. Well, that sounds complicated, but it isn't. Ezekiel is taken out of the north gate because only God is to use the east gate, as we saw in the last study. And he's taken round to that east gate, and looking eastward, behold, there ran out waters on the right side. And then in verse 3, the measuring begins. And when the man that had the line in his hand went forth eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits. Now we've seen already that in the prophecy of Ezekiel, the cubit is about 2 feet. It's not the usual 20 inches. It's been detailed, described, and it, general agreement, it comes to about 2 feet. And so 1,000 of them, you're talking about 3/8 of a mile. And he brought me through the waters, and here's the significant statement, the waters were to the ankles after just 3/8 of a mile. This sheet of water has become ankle deep. And verse 4, he measured another 3/8 of a mile and brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the knees. This is going to be very significant. Again, he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters were to the loins. Then in verse 5, it became, after another 1,000 cubits, a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in, a river that could not be passed over. So it's getting deeper and deeper. And after only 1.5 miles, it's a deep river, impossible to wade across, a water only for swimming. And this is so significant that in verse 6, Ezekiel is told, "Son of man, hast thou seen this?" This is something to be particularly noted and marked. Then he brought me, the implication is, back along the bank and caused me to return to the brink of the river. So in those first 7 verses, you have a phenomenon that cannot be taken literally. A river flowing from an impossible place and gaining in depth and probably width immensely, until it's quite a flowing torrent and extremely deep within only that 1.5 miles. So this is something which depicts something very special, a spiritual fulfillment. We're not looking at a geographical description here. And in verse 7, now when I had returned, behold, see, as though it's something surprising, something certainly that Ezekiel hadn't noticed before. His attention had been so engaged by the remarkable river, or what he was to see next had been withheld from him until the right time. Behold, at the bank of the river were very many trees on the one side and on the other. You would have expected him to have noticed them. An almost forest lining either bank. Very many trees. But no, it's being unfolded to him stage by stage. And then there's an explanation of where the river goes. Verse 8, They issue out toward the east country. They go down into the desert, which could also be translated the plain, and go into the sea, which would be the Dead Sea, in that direction. Which being brought into the sea, the waters shall be healed. Well, that will be very remarkable. So that at last, fish can live in that particular sea, that salt sea. And it shall come to pass, verse 9, that everything that liveth, that won't be a literal everything, because the passage goes on to speak of death. It means that all kinds of people, everything that liveth, which moveth, whithersoever the river shall come or touch, shall live. There'll be life. It's a river of life. It's a figure. It's a picture. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come thither. And the explanation, for they shall be healed, and everything shall live whither the river cometh. It will spread life where previously there was death. And anticipating our explanation, you can already begin to see that here is the conversion of the Gentiles. Here's the gospel going out far beyond Israel to places that were polytheistic and far away and antagonistic, will be brought to life just as a Dead Sea will be brought to life. Everything shall live whither the river cometh. It will be a source of life. And then it proceeds to say in verse 10 that there'll be fish like the fish of the great sea. Well, that is another strange piece of information, because this would be presumably a freshwater river, if we're to take it literally, flowing from the, impossibly from the Temple Mount, and yet it's to have the very same fish that will be found in salt water in the Mediterranean. So, of course, it's a figure, it's a picture. Ezekiel isn't making mistakes. He's constantly leaving these indications that we're speaking in pictures, not in realities. There'll be vast numbers of fish representing life in this great sea, exceeding many, repeated yet again. But verse 11, the miry places thereof, and the marishes or marshes thereof, shall not be healed. They shall be given to salt. People who are on the very fringes of the influence of this river are not touched by it, and their death prevails. And that helps us to interpret the earlier verse that said that everything that liveth, which moveth, wherever the rivers come, shall live. Not quite everything. There'll still be death. There'll still be areas uninfluenced by the life-giving power of the river. And of course it's so, because this looks forward to the gospel age. Well, what does the river do? Well, we've already seen a lot of information, and we can begin to apply it. This river of life, what's it going to accomplish? We can be satisfied that the river, it's the same river that other prophets speak of, that in the day of Christ, in that day, the language of prophecy, in that day, repeated so many times, the day of Christ, the day of the Messiah, the day when the branch comes, in that day, a river shall flow from the city of God and will water everywhere. This is the same river. It's the river of life of the gospel age. That's what the prophecy is about. Now, friends who interpret the Old Testament according to the rules of dispensationalism, who want everything to be literal, virtually empty these chapters of their meaning. Many of them are good people and good exegetes in other parts of the scripture and, good interpreters anywhere but in prophecy. But the idea that this is to be taken literally is not only impossible, but it's fruitless. There's no benefit, no message, no merit in it. I noted that the MacArthur Study Bible says rather unhelpfully, this chapter deals with the changes in the water in the coming, in his view, millennium, thousand-year rule. Dealing only with the changes in the water? Are you only noting the measurements, the dimensions, the depth, and things like that? No, it's a figure. It's teaching us of things that will take place in the age of the gospel. And here it is, the elaboration. Verse 9, it's life. Everything that liveth, which moveth, whithersoever the river shall come, whatever the river affects and touches, shall live. Vast number of fish, healing, and so on. We've seen the fishermen in verse 10, the dead fringes in verse 11, verse 12, which is a kind of elaboration, all manner of fruit trees, evergreens, strangely, fruits that never withers, fruiting every month, all because the water comes from the sanctuary and the river of life flows from the sanctuary. The fulfillment of the ancient sanctuary from Christ, from Calvary. Well, first of all, let me get down to application. In verse 1, it comes from under the threshold of the house. The river of life in the age of the gospel has a secret source, an unseen source. Where does salvation begin? It begins in secret. It begins in that impossible to see place. It begins in the eternal counsel of God before the cosmos was created. It begins in the decree of God who looks forward to the creation of the world, to the sad and tragic fall of man, to the redemption that he will bring about, to the people who he will save. And in the eternal counsel, in the eternal decree, it is determined that the second person of the Trinity will come and make a way of salvation and suffer an atoning death. The election of God takes place in that eternal counsel. So it's a secret source. The conversions that we see, the work of God, the history of the church and of the gospel, it actually has that secret source, has another secret source. The inner agony of Calvary, the extent of suffering, the price of salvation, which you cannot see, which cannot be truly reflected in the external wounds of Christ, that inner separation of soul from the Father, the agonies of Calvary. It's reflected also in the work in our own hearts. I could turn to the Gospel of John and chapter 3 and those so famous words in verse 8. The Lord explains the new birth. The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit. There's that inner work of the Spirit, secret and invisible to us, whereby the soul is regenerated and the eyes are opened, and you begin to understand the Word of God, and your will is inclined to believe, and the irresistible work of grace takes place. Whether you're looking at the whole way of salvation or the salvation of an individual soul, it has a secret source. So the river of life flows from that invisible source under the threshold. And the second thing that we see in these verses, and I won't go specifically to them, is the extraordinarily rapid rise, extent, depth and power of this river. And so it is. After Pentecost, the ancient world was overwhelmed, almost. The advance of the gospel was so rapid throughout the then world. And to Europe, to Africa, in no time at all, If a church is springing up, you see it in the book of Acts. You see the history of the ministry of the Apostle Paul, and not only him, but vast numbers of workers saved through his ministry. People also from Jerusalem, people who'd been at the day of Pentecost, converted Jews and proselytes, and they were dispersed and they went everywhere proclaiming the gospel. And thousands upon thousands in land after land were converted. And in no time you have the mighty Roman Empire bowing to the Church of Jesus Christ. So the rapid rise of the salvation of the Gentiles and the extent and the power, the great changes which took place, people who'd been lifelong polytheists, so deepened and darkened by superstition, and yet in a moment changed and released from all those fetters and brought to an understanding of the gospel and of the things of God. And so there's deep change and whole societies are influenced. Again, let me recommend you, if you haven't already read it, that book by Vishal Mangalwadi, the Indian intellectual, the book that changed your world. I commend it to you all. The history of the influence of the Bible on Western nations after, since the Reformation. An extraordinary story. Just to focus on it for a while. Well, like a river flowing forth from Jerusalem, so the gospel goes out from Calvary and the day of Pentecost. And now let me just read you a few verses from Isaiah chapter 35. You know these verses well. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. Strengthen ye the weak hands, confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. This is the same river, the same gospel age. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert, and the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of dragons where each lay shall be grass with reeds and rushes. Nearly 200 years before Ezekiel, Isaiah was inspired with a remarkably similar picture of the coming age. Let me talk briefly about the purifying influence of this river of life. Forgiveness, healing, transformation, not only the forgiveness of sin, but the changing of the life. Then, spiritual life, communion with God, it's all there. A new worldview. Oh, that grand old illustration serves us well in so many ways. Before conversion, you're like a goldfish in a bowl. All you can see in distorted form, perhaps, a little bit outside the bowl. But it's all so indistinct. That bowl circumscribes your world and your experience. But conversion, the river of life, brings you out of that bowl and you get a new worldview. You can see this is a fallen world. You can see it's a created world. You understand the scriptures. You understand who you are and where you are in this world and where it's going. You have a whole new worldview you never had before. You could be a university professor, a Nobel Prize winner, a brilliant individual, applauded by everyone, but unconverted. When it comes to a worldview, you're still in that goldfish bowl. You can't see spiritual realities. And that's the river of life, with healing and with transformation. And it's sustaining and upbuilding. there are many, many fishermen along the banks, and they're netting the great fish that constitutes spiritual food, along with the leaves, the fruits of the trees. There's so much information, learning, pleasures of truth and reality to be gleaned from the river of life. And everything that it touches lives. So this is about our influence, dear friends, in the world. Let me give you an example of this that many people have charted and we read about. Take our present society. One thing we benefit from immensely in the West and in society generally is the concept of equality. Equality of men and women and races, of all human beings before God. How did that ever get into modern society? The notion of equality? Well, of course, it comes from the Bible. But it was lost for many centuries. Not entirely lost. There was the liberation of the serfs and so on. But it didn't amount to much as far as equality was concerned. There was still very much a tiered society. And it bound you and limited you. But where did it come from? Whoever suddenly decided all men and women are equal? What shook the stranglehold of inequality after the Dark Ages? Well, the first people to strike inequality were the old Anabaptists. And you know where they got it from? The priesthood of all believers. The New Testament doctrine of the priesthood of all believers. And the obvious implication of the priesthood of all believers was the equality of men and women. And within a matter of years, I'm not saying he got it from them, he got it from the scriptures, but the Anabaptists got it first in the modern world. Very soon afterwards, it was Luther. The priesthood of all believers. And the clergy and the priesthood fell and crashed. And with it, although there was great deference to royalty for practical reasons and so on, soon the divine right of kings would come tumbling down after it. Everything would fall, and the concept of liberty would be understood and grasped. And it came into the Western world through the Reformation, through the priesthood of all believers. Many people have charted that. I think there's little or no question of that. That's real history, equality before God. Well, dear friends, in America, in 1740, dear George Whitefield preached a great sermon to Christians. And it was published and printed, and it became notorious. Why, some people called it seditious, and so on. George Whitefield, was very concerned about the treatment of slaves. He actually had slaves, but he didn't treat them like anybody else. And he preached this sermon on the equality of men. And was taken up by many, by intellectuals, by even people who weren't particularly Christian in society. Thomas Jefferson famously took it up. And I think the date is 1776, when the first draft of the American Declaration of Independence was done. Thomas Jefferson insisted it went in. Of course, it didn't get fulfilled or carried out in America fully understood for many years. But I noted Thomas Jefferson's original words. These didn't exactly get in to the Declaration of Independence. They got in, but vital words were taken out. We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, that all men are created equal. What did Thomas Jefferson mean by sacred? That was taken out of the final document. Sacred. Well, he meant from the Bible. He'd learned it from George Whitefield. Now it's sought after in a large part of the world as an essential principle of society and life and living. Where did it come from? Luther's Reformation. The priesthood of all believers. Why am I spending so long with this? You know, this river of life is so remarkable that it saves millions, billions, and brings them to God. And it leaves also, by the way, incidentally, staggeringly wonderful benefits, even to unbelieving society, that these days doesn't appreciate where any of it came from. But that's the reality. The river of life. We've had some amazing reformers in the history of the Christian church. Perhaps one of the very greatest was Anthony Ashley Cooper, 7th Earl of Shaftesbury. Well, you know all about him. You may not have seen it so strongly attributed to him as it ought to have been, but I think everybody's studied the history of the lunacy laws. That was his first triumph. The limitation of child labour, the factory acts, he started all that off. The restriction of harsh circumstances for minors, the banning of the little lads as chimney sweeps, so many education reforms, and numerous charities founded or encouraged or enabled by him. Well, you know that he's commemorated at Piccadilly Circus by that memorial statue, topped so strangely by the figure of a mythical Greek god, commonly called Eros, but it's not Eros, it's Anteros. Eros's better behaved brother, whose name means love returned. That's possibly how he got on there, but still it wouldn't have pleased the 7th Earl of Shaftesbury to have a pagan memorial. However, and people say to me, they say, well, shouldn't we be doing social reform in the churches and good works and things of this kind? Isn't that also from the great river of life? Well, the principle in the Bible is in Psalm 33, and you know it well, I'm sure. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. It is a principle of the Word of God, not only there, but in many related and parallel texts, that God's people and the river of life are most able to do good to society as a whole when society receives the gospel. It's in the times of great gospel reception that there follows in its wake many privileges, even for unbelieving society. And so it was in our great Victorian age. It wasn't so great in many, many ways, but there were vast numbers of believers and tremendous reverence to God. And so there came in great blessings through the church and through individual dignitaries who had been saved, which affected all society. Today, I don't want to confuse you with this, but today there are some Christians and even evangelical Christians who are telling us that it is part of our work as Christians to reform the world. That is not a biblical view. That is a relatively modern view. It is not part of our work. It is not part of something, a work that results from the resurrection of Christ, as is falsely claimed. This comes from liberal theology, that Christian people have a parallel mission, not only to win souls, but to restore a good and a perfect earth. That is a nonsense. good works in the world are enabled and blessed as a fruit of the reception of the gospel. And wherever nations, peoples in any large numbers have received the gospel, there have followed tremendous benefits through individuals working through the church. Some people take another approach to this, which is equally mistaken, and they say, well, of course, unless we do good works and found wonderful institutions and so on, people will not believe the gospel. So good works come first as pre-evangelism, to soften people up, as it were, to give them a good impression of the church and of the word of God. Well, friends, how do you answer that? You just cast your mind back to the New Testament church. What did they do? What did they do? What great social reforms did they organize? What did they set about seeking to? Nothing. They preached the gospel. And as they preached the gospel, and as they won souls, and as multitudes were converted, then there was following on behind a mighty social effect. And so it has been down the ages. Our primary work, let's say our first task is the gospel. Our second task is the gospel. Our third task is the gospel. Our fourth task is the gospel. That is the great reforming influence. And as the gospel is received, God will raise up among us those who have opportunity, like the privileged Auntie Ashley Cooper, born into the aristocracy, virtually born into being an MP and a member of the House of Lords and a member of the Cabinet. Doesn't happen these days, but God so ordered it years ago. They were a great friend of C.H. Spurgeon's, by the way, and they were able to do mighty things. And that's the way round. It's all a result. It's all a fruit. But enough of that. It's the river of life itself we're talking about, and I'm over time, but I'd like to make a final personal application. Once you see this, and you see that we are a separate people, we're not interested in the world for its own sake. We're not worldlings. We protect ourselves from the baneful influences of the world, and yet we're set by God to win people from the world. God is gathering out a people, and to do such good as we can, incidentally to the work of the gospel, we're set to influence the world, but not to be part of it, and not to be influenced by it. But this is how it influences us individuals. Let me put it this way as I come to conclusion. There will be people among us here tonight, I hope not many, but it is inevitable that there will be some with us here tonight, who profess Christ, who move among us, who pass as Christians, but as their lives unfold, they will gravitate to worldly self-indulgence. They're not really in favor of complete dedication to the Lord. They want to be of this place, this world, and tasting its dainties, and enjoying its comforts, and identifying with it. Their minds will be set much more on their careers, and their families, and their ever more beautiful homes, and they're moving to ever bigger, better motor cars, and signs of social success. And somewhere or other they'll find some perverse Christian teacher who is proclaiming something like, oh, your first task as a Christian is not to be rushing about, like some people do, talking about serving the Lord and doing this and doing that. Your first task is to look after your family and to do well in life and to honour the Lord in that way. And not to be busy on the things of God, but to be focusing on your soul and your understanding and improving your earthly lot. And they will say, ah, That's where I am. That's for me. And there will be some friends Why, great writer at the time of the Great Awakening, in the 19th century awakening, that is, wrote this, that when the Spirit of God moves and there's a great wave of blessing bringing many people into the church, there is flotsam and jetsam swept in by the tide, by the flood, mixed up with the people of God. It's not a very nice way of putting it, I agree, but as time goes on, the people who are unconverted, or the people who are very susceptible to worldly temptations, drift to the fringe, are not in the service of the Lord. This chapter is about, look, we have a tremendous inheritance. We're the people of God. We're not of this world. We're not in this world. We have a mission in this world. We are represented by this great river of life. We're influencing souls. We're giving our lives to that. We're dedicated to that. That's our chief priority. That's our calling. That's true Christianity. And I hope, I would hope, that everyone in our congregation, in our fellowship, was minded for this. But that's a lot to hope. There are always some who fall short of that. That's very sad. And you realise as time goes on, they're either not converted, they haven't got the instincts of a truly converted person, or they've been ensnared early in their Christian lives by worldly tastes. But this is the book of the prophet Ezekiel. All these images, pictures of the gospel age and the river of life is our influence within the world. Lifelong witnessing, serving the Lord, seeking to bring in a new generation, not of this world, being careful what we buy, being careful what we're ensnared by, being careful where our wrong tastes would take us. This is about the committed Christian life. Well, let's close singing together the hymn 461.